Okay, my name's Daniel Monk. I'm from the law school here at Birkbeck, and I'm going to be chairing this next session. There are three papers. The first paper is by John Chalcroft, Dissent, Post-Hegemony and Boycott, Divestment Sanctions. The second paper is The Ethics of Boycotts by Oliver Lehman. And the third paper is Anti-Israel Boycotts and American Anti-Discrimination Law from Kenneth Marcus. Our first speaker, John Chalcroft, is from the London School of Economics. He's a reader in the history and politics of empire and imperialism. His research focuses on history from below in the Middle East, and he's the author of The Striking Cabbies of Cairo and Other Stories, and The Invisible Cage, Syrian Migrant Workers in Lebanon. He's currently writing a book on transnational popular politics and protest movements in the making of the modern Arab world. Oliver Lehman is professor of philosophy at the University of Kentucky and is the author of books on Islamic and Jewish philosophy and theology. And Kenneth Marcus is the Louis D. Brandeis from the Louis D. Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law in Washington. He's the president and general counsel of the Louis D. Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law and the author of Jewish Identity and Civil Rights in America. And he has served as staff director of the United States Commission on Civil Rights and was delegated the authority of Assistant Secretary of Education for Civil Rights and Assistant Secretary of Housing and Urban Development for Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity. He also serves as associate editor of the Journal for the Study of Anti-Semitism. So with no further ado, I'm going to invite John to come up and give the first paper.
Okay, so the BDS movement and the question of horizontalism. Let me start with Ehud Barak. There are some pretty powerful elements in the world that are active in the matter, in various organizations of workers, academics, consumers, green parties, and this drive boils down to a large movement called BDS, which is what they did with South Africa. It won't happen all at once. It will begin like an iceberg to advance on us from all quarters. The BDS movement emerged in the occupied Palestinian territories and more globally in the wake of the collapse of the Oslo process and the struggles surrounding the Second Intifada. Diplomacy, governments, negotiation, and armed struggle, and arguably Hamas-style communalism had all failed to secure Palestinian rights. And the hope of the Oslo process, two national states side by side, was in ruins, destroyed above all, arguably, by the unwillingness of the Israeli state, the dominant power, to give up control of the OPT, expressed in occupation, settlements, road construction, land confiscations, wall building, checkpoint siege, and periodic military operations. In various parts of the world, elements drawn from student groups, academics, trade unions, church groups, artists, writers, intellectuals, musicians, filmmakers, progressive Jews, Palestinians, the global justice movement, and old one staters, ex-believers in the Oslo process, they started to think in terms of using the power of Palestinian and global civil society to force Israel to concede Palestinian rights through a campaign of boycott, divestment, and sanctions on the model of the campaign that changed the world for the better by helping to bring down apartheid system set up by another settler society, this time in South Africa. Now controversy rages about the movement. For Harold Brackman of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, it is an anti-Semitic poison pill. For Omar Barghouti of the movement, it is a moral and effective form of civil nonviolent resistance. So what kind of a movement is it? This paper proposes to tackle this question by comparing and contrasting the movement with another contemporary form of activism, horizontalism, associated with directly democratic forms of organizing from Argentina to Tahrir and Occupy! Exclamation mark. So I might be a proud member of the movement, but my methods are not arbitrary. In fact, originally it was study that led me to activism, not activism that led me to study, although now these elements are mutually reinforcing. Before we point fingers, let us not forget that many of us have stakes in one way or another in this issue. I'm a historian of labor, migration, and protest in the Middle East and North Africa, and I've been developing a distinctive analytic framework to write histories of popular movements. My approach is intended to avoid hydraulic, culturalist and power-light theories of protest and contention alike. I emphasize against economism, cultural, political, and social forms, against post-structuralism, the forcefulness of resistance, and against voluntarism, the importance of power structures. I define a popular movement as a transgressive, collective, mobilizing project. It's a distinctive definition for lots of reasons which we can go into later. Definition is intended to draw attention to the way in which in popular movements you have a socio-political project. And the idea here is to flesh out what that socio-political project is in regard to BDS. And I single out seven crucial elements to do with identification, principle, enemies, goals, organization, tactics, and strategies. This paper uses this anatomy of popular movements to compare horizontalism with BDS. So what's horizontalism? Well, the idea of horizontalism, horizontalidad, was coined to characterize the movements and directly democratic styles of organizing that emerged in Latin America in the 2000s, following the economic crisis. These movements set great store by being prefigurative. They're supposed to prefigure in the very way they organize the future alternative that they hope to embody along the way. Second, they're non-ideological. They do not seek to apply an ideological program or blueprint to the social form, especially not through the agency of the state. Third, they're rhizomic. They favor a more decentralized, networked, and rhizomic mode. You know, the idea of the rhizome, it's a botanical metaphor. It comes from the idea of roots that web together in a lattice with nodes where the bits of the lattice cross. In the rhizomic form, the boundaries of the organization are not policed with doctrinal tests and expulsions. Horizontalism instead thinks of multiplying the points of a rhizomic network. Rhizomic organizing stresses deliberation, not representation, and the decentralization of decision-making capacity. It makes a great deal of use of general assemblies, popular committees, and coordinating networks, rather than parties, unions, and established NGOs or the state. It has a lot to say about leaderlessness, or it even prefers to speak of leaderfulness. It involves an emphatic rejection of the idea of sole leaders with their singular, all-knowing strategies, a Lenin, a Khomeini, a Nasser, or a Chavez. Instead, horizontalist movements prefer to unlock the power of the diverse, multicolored, and multitudinous subjectivities that make up the movement, eschewing bureaucratic and vanguardist forms. Such movements are thus leaderful. They are creative. They involve points of intelligent decision. They're 2.0 movements that some people want to speak of. Users create the content they use. That's why you have this affinity with social media, mobile phones, and so on, which allow user-guided content. The style of organizing is supposed to be creative, expressive, and even pleasurable, and even festive. It's not disciplinarian, sectarian, or authoritarian. Although it's not a free-for-all, there are an enormous number of procedures. Finally, the mode of integration. Well, it's not that of the traditional collective subject. You don't constitute a people or a nation or a proletariat or a woman or a Jew or a Muslim. That's too essentialist and conformist. No, horizontalists prefer the idea of a motley multitude in the tradition of Spinoza and the anarchist Marxist philosophers Hart and Negri, who speak of diverse singularities with autonomy, creativity, united by a network. And finally, as for tactics, horizontalists like the idea of direct action, not claim-making and supplicating before authorities, not the demonstration, but occupation, not petitions and appeals, but civil disobedience, not customer services, but hacktivism. They stage spectacular events in addition to shock-received wisdom. There is in this an implicit and explicit rejection of existing institutions, the state, and existing political channels, including even parliaments and parties, which are seen as corrupted and impotent. So that's something about horizontalism. So the idea is to turn to BDS and look at my 7 points and see overlaps and similarities. I want to compare that socio-political project with that of the BDS movement. Well, first of all, we spoke about principles of identification and integration. Who is involved in the BDS movement? Well, there's an implicit horizontalism here, but not an explicit one. The BDS doesn't self-identify as horizontalist. Activists don't walk around saying, we are horizontals, they are verticals. But such talk was definitely intertwined with the Occupy movement, say, or in New York, if you read David Graeber's book. Nonetheless, some of the most acute conflicts that played themselves out in the movement do have to do with the negotiation of how do parties, vertical forms of organization, unions, and constituted authorities fit with the BDS network. And we've had those conflicts in the UK, and you have them in Palestine too, vis-a-vis Hamas, Fatah, and the PA. And there's lots of examples and evidence for that in my written paper. But we note that boycotters are not seeking to impose an ideological blueprint. They don't actually adopt a specific ideology. There's no wandering along the Corniche in Alexandria, thumbing a copy of Das Kapital. There's not a conversion ideological process that goes on when you join the BDS movement. BDS organizers do not set aside days for studying Maoism or socialism like the PLO training camps did in the 1950s and 60s. So we can speak of it as a movement that doesn't adopt an ideological program in a meaningful sense, which of course has an overlap with horizontalism. Then there's the question of nationalism. Isn't that rather a traditional form of collective subjectivity? Nationalism is, of course, a key element in the BDS movement. Palestinian nationalist. In some respects, it's a Palestinian nationalist movement with supporters overseas, no doubt. But the picture is a little bit more complicated. First, with the death of the two-state solution. Second, the rise of one-staters in the movement. And third, the existence of those who refuse to comment on the question of a programmatic solution involving nationalism makes it less possible to assume that the movement is integrated by a straightforward adherence to the idea of the Palestinian nation. Visceral or romantic nationalism or ethnic nationalism plays little or no role in the discourse of the movement. The gap between nation and territory is enunciated in the one-state idea. There is no elevation of the nation to the principle, to a sacred principle, as in the Ba'athist movement, one Arab nation with an eternal mission. You don't see that kind of language in the BDS movement. So my thesis here, tentative, is that the idea of nationalism is, it serves as an invitation to the instantiation of certain rights. That's how it works in the discourse of the BDS movement. So this brings me to believe that the concept of the multitude is highly suggestive in terms of how should we understand the principle of integration at work in the BDS movement. Because you don't join the movement as a worker, as a peasant, as a member of the struggling masses, or even as a student. You don't join the worker as a representative of the workers of France, for example. You don't, the organization, the fact that the different organizations have come out of different national states is by default, not by design. Boycotters, of course, are from highly diverse ethnic, religious, national, and class backgrounds. They include Muslims, Jews, Christians, Israelis, British, French, Indians, Egyptians, and so on. They're racially and ethnically mixed. There are celebrities such as Elvis Costello. There are ordinary people living in cul-de-sacs in the suburbs of Sheffield. Boycotters, thus, are a motley patchwork of different subjectivities, from Pakistan to Los Angeles. Traditional notions of identity will not do. It's hard to avoid the thesis that they are a multitude in the sense meant by Hart and Negri. I think that concept covers quite well the principle of integration at stake. Diverse and sometimes singular subjectivities connected by a lattice-like network with points of autonomy and creativity at the intersections of that network. So if that's our principle of integration, what does the BDS movement actually stand for? Well, the prefigurative idea, it's not that important. You do have people who elevate the notion of non-violence to a philosophy. i.e. a prefigurative notion of what the society will become like. You have other people that speak about the BDS movement as democracy in action, but it's not that important. So what does the BDS movement stand for? Well, it's Barghouti's insistence, who's one of the main activists, a Palestinian activist, his insistence that the BDS movement adopts a rights-based approach that best captures this. Boycotters are those who support rights, rights which don't just belong to Palestinians or Arabs. They're supposed to be, and insistently supposed to be, universal rights. Freedom, equality, and self-determination. They're supposed to be rights that anyone would sign up to, regardless of their class, their ethnicity, and so on. And it's these rights are supposed to be in support of those who, under total occupation, must carry out a bitter struggle simply to carry on their daily life. And of course, there's an interesting echo here of the rights struggle that was embodied in the Land League against Charles Boycott in Ireland in 1880. It stood for three rights, they said: fair rent, fixity of tenure, and free sale. So it's not a new idea. But the rights are bestowed contra Hannah Arendt, not by the state. They're inalienable rights that are supposedly rooted in civil society, which is an interesting and dramatic position to take for a stateless people. The rights-based approach helps to explain the insistence on international law and human rights that are so much part of the discourse of the movement. And I could pile up the evidence for that, but I don't think I should. Because I want to get on to this question of enemies. But to say that the insistence on the generative capacity of civil society echoes in some respects the idea within horizontalist movements that the state is not the source of rights. The insistence on rights, however, is something that horizontalism largely takes as read. For BDS, it must be fought for. So if the BDS movement's mode of identification and integration is multitudinous, and if what it stands for are rights, what is it against? Well, it's useful to turn to what happened at the World Conference Against Racism, held in Durban in 2001, for some illumination on this point. Their occupation and Zionism was equated with racism and apartheid. And a call went out to the international community to sanction Israel with the intention of bringing about an end to these illegal practices and ensuring compliance with international law. Now, that's quite a dramatic innovation in discursive terms, because Israel is not positioned as being part of a network of neo-colonial, imperialist, and capitalist exploitation. Nor is it seen merely in legal terms as an occupier who violates the law. It is seen that the key to this is that the occupation expresses a prior form of essentialist, repressive, and hierarchical discursive closure, racism. This equation of Zionism and racism was one of the key innovations of the Durban Conference, and unsurprisingly controversial. It marked the end of the radical critique of Israeli practices through the lenses of capitalism, imperialism, and militarism, and the beginning of the critique of Israel in terms of racism, ethnocracy, and communalism. A multitudinous rights struggle had found its exact nemesis and antagonist, a form of racialized discursive closure. Not long after Zionism had lost what remained of its labor Zionist form and shifted increasingly to the right, it was identified with a species of exclusionary and chauvinist communalism, a totalizing and essentializing identitarianism. And of course, there's a powerful echo of Leclerc Mouffe's radically democratic program as set out in the 1980s, which was a signal moment for the post-Marxist left in terms of what it was that they were fighting against. We must note that the enemy here is not a race or an ethnicity. It's not the Jews, it's not crusaders, it's not Christians, it's not infidels, it's not even a country, it's not Israel as such. The target here differs markedly, for example, than the enemies perceived by Hamas, who do speak about Jews and crusaders. The enemy in the BDS movement is instead a system of oppression that organizes rights according to ethnic and religious privilege. That point can hardly be overemphasized. The call is no more against Israel than the BDS movement was against South Africa. To speak of the BDS movement being against South Africa rather than being against apartheid is lazy, it's imprecise, and extremely costly. The BDS call is against a system of oppression that is guaranteed by a repressive form of discursive closure. Communalism, in a word. Lots of evidence to back that up, but I think it explains why someone like Ilan Pappe sees 1948 not in terms of collusion across the Jordan, not in terms of a war with a refugee problem attached, as in Benny Morris. He sees it as a question of ethnic cleansing. He sees it through this lens of communalism, that this is the enemy now, and it's a form of discursive closure. And there's a lot of evidence for that. So that's what the movement's against. What it stands for, what its objectives are these kinds of rights. I have to close. What it's and in terms of its organization, its tactics and strategy, well, I had to leave out anyway from most of the paper the evaluation of these tactics, but we notice, the short story is that there are affinities with the rhizome. The tactics, we know what the tactics are. They're pretty. My argument is that they're clear. The tactics are the withdrawal of cooperation, social ostracism, and legal and state-based penalties. Those are the tactics. It's not complicated. And my argument over strategy, that's not complicated either. The strategy is clear. It is A, to weaken the institutional capacity of the oppressive system at stake, and B, to break up the discursive closure that backs the institutions in the first place. So, and the argument here is it's more strategically and tactically concrete than Hamas, but it sits within a horizontalist repertoire. So my conclusion is simply to note that there are a number of similarities and differences between horizontalism and this kind of activism. And I've run out of time, but my assessment is that each movement can learn from the other. Horizontalists could learn something about goals and strategy from the BDS movement, and the BDS movement could learn something about the multitudinous and rhizomic forms from the horizontalists. But in a way, I wanted to say that BDS is horizontalism on steroids, because it adds direzioni, what Gramsci called the idea of the modern prince. It adds that to a fundamentally powerful organizational form. Thank you.